Coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Apropos of Something. This is a new special show. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio, and I like to say Persistence Radio. We usually air from 10 to 11 on every Saturday morning, which we did today, and today we have an additional show. This is a special show in honor of the authors here for the Virginia Festival of the Book. We spoke to two authors earlier this morning. At this hour, we're speaking to a poet and a technology entrepreneur. I'm Ellen Daniels, your co-host in Charlottesville, and Nancy Lawrence, co-hosts from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, as promised, we're speaking with multi-award-winning poet Leona Sevick. She is provost and professor of English at Bridgewater College in Virginia. We're lucky to have her while she's in Charlottesville for the Festival of the Book. Leona is the winner of the 2017 Press 53 Award for Poetry, her first full-length book of poems, Lion Brothers. And we're talking with Alexander Zaretta, a technology entrepreneur just named the 2019 Innovator of the Year Award by Charlottesville Business Innovation Council. He's a professor at the University of Virginia School of Engineering and Applied Science, helping young entrepreneurs by developing programs with intentionally designed peer influences. Speaking of my peer and my good friend, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I'm here at noon for the Virginia Festival of the Broadcast. Why don't we just?
I'm going to start.
Their great idea and
I'm going to start getting greedy and just wanting to do a show every other hour. You know, every weekend.
Whose idea was that? No, anyway.
I know. You really made us overachievers. I have to say, I'm putting it on you. Because
that's true. We're getting extra credit from no one. We do it anyway.
But there's no end.
So do you think Russia will tell us what's in the report before William Barr does?
That's gosh. That is the best question.
Wouldn't that just be apropos of this this criminality?
You know,
Russia probably already knows.
What if the final page of the Mueller report is a March Madness bracket?
As long as Trump's in the middle behind bars, I'm all for it. That's all I'm asking.
John Meacham has said that this report's going to shape American politics for years. Well, I mean, kind of like the racist, fascist policies that are happening right now.
Yes, we cannot forget we're soaking in it constantly. I know. Whether it rises to the level of indictments or not, there's enough criminality of just... Not living up to the oath of office, which is just as important. I'll stop right
there. Yeah, we can impeach for that, right?
Yes, they have done it before. Yeah, or they tried to until someone resigned, as I recall. Anyway, I'm sure I know someone who's not listening. And that's probably Jared Kushner. He's probably busy putting this report on a WhatsApp
on his private server.
Yeah, right. For the entire Eastern Bloc. Anyway,
all right. He and Josh. Is it Josh? He's got a brother.
Yeah, he's got a brother.
There's a J.
Yeah.
Doing the same kind of deeds. Well, anyway, with no further ado, I wanted to introduce our first guest. She is, as I mentioned, the provost and professor of English at Virginia's Bridgewater College. She is an award-winning poet here for the Virginia Festival of the Book. Her first full-length book of poems, Lion Brothers, is the winner of the 2017 Press 53 Award for Poetry. She's on the advisory board of Furious Flower Poetry Center. She was the Tennessee Williams Scholar for the Sewanee Writers Conference in 2018, and she was nominated for a Pushcart Prize last year. She's appeared in several anthologies. Noteworthy is the Golden Shovel Anthology, 2017. Her other accolades are too numerous to mention in this introduction. She'll have to tell us a little bit about herself in person. And welcome to the show, Leona.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So you're very welcome. Lion Brothers is your first full-length book of poems, and one reviewer called it a seductive book, one that takes the joys and terrors of dozens of ordinary Wednesdays and from them finds revelatory insights that answer the most fundamental questions about who we are. That is quite a lot. So does writing help you find the answers?
I think it does. It's a process for me. I spend a lot of time in my head, and so writing helps me sort of move through some of those ideas, and sometimes I don't know where the poems are going until I get to the very end. So.
And Leona, you did not start out as a poet. This is new to you. Why is this new to you?
It is. So I was trained as an Americanist, late 19th, early 20th century American literature. I was actually a Willa Cather scholar, and I started writing poetry about 10 years ago. And I was sitting in a bar, actually, and I wrote my first poem on a napkin. That's actually how it happened. And
Did you do that intentionally? Like, I'm going to write on a napkin.
No, I didn't have anything else to write on. I've since changed that practice. I carry something with me to write on at every moment. But that's what happened. And I wrote another poem, and I wrote another poem, and then I was hooked. And suddenly, research didn't seem as exciting to me. So I was working on a book on Cather, and I actually stopped working on that book because writing poems was just so much more fulfilling and exciting for me.
Did you mention it was a contest?
So my very first contest win was in 2012. I won the Split This Rock poetry contest. And the judge is a wonderful poet, a poet I very much admire. Her name is Naomi Shihab Nye. And she picked my poem, and that was really life changing for me. And I knew I had an audience, and then I just kept going.
And of the writing possibilities for you, was poetry on your radar, even if you weren't taking it seriously at that time, or not?
It was on my radar because I've taught for I can't believe I'm going to say this, but almost 30 years, and so I've taught a lot of poetry, and that was part of the dilemma. I think you know, sometimes when you're teaching and reading wonderful poetry, you suffer from a kind of it's Harold Bloom's anxiety of influence, and so it was difficult to write my own work when I was, I think, constantly comparing it to wonderful work that I was reading and teaching. But then at some point I decided to let all of that go. And again, you know, when you start acquiring a reading audience and you know that people connect with your work, you start losing that anxiety of influence.
So what inspired the poems that are in your latest book, Lion Brothers?
So as many poets do, I look around me, and sometimes I fasten on the subjects that are closest to me, much to the chagrin of my family and my kids. I write a lot of poems about family. I have lots of son and daughter poems. I have some parent poems, some marriage poems. I have poems about the work life. And so mostly I write about things that are immediately present to me.
I was actually wondering about that. I will step off of the lane with the Lion Brothers theme and ask, what is that like? Do you hear from these people, your family, you're with them, so when they come up in a poem, what happens?
Oh, well, they don't always like the poem. No, I don't mind. They don't always like the poems that I write about them. I have a series of poems I like to call bad mother poems. And they're about those, you know, those moments when I fail as a parent, you know, and I say the thing that I shouldn't say, or maybe don't do the thing that I'm supposed to do. And because that occupies my brain space for a long time, that's what comes out in the poetry. And, you know, my kids have listened to me read a number of times, and eventually they get to a place where they start requesting poems. And so even if they're not so comfortable with them at first, they grow more comfortable with them.
Leona, what do you love about poetry?
I love that... you know, when you start writing and you attend to words so carefully, you cannot contrive where the poem will go. It travels in its own space, and it it decides its own length in many ways. And it decides what shape it's going to become. And I love that, again, when I start something, I don't know where I'll finish. It's very different from the kind of literary criticism that I practiced in the past. You know, when you're creating an argument, you make a claim and you support that argument, you know where it will end, with maybe just a few turns in the process. But with poetry, you have no idea. I have no idea. Maybe some other poets are a little bit different, but I write through feeling and ideas, and I love to find out where I'm going to end.
Does a first draft, do you have a draft? I don't know, it sounds like such a fiction thing, but do you have a draft, and does it change from start to finish dramatically if you do?
I'm a terribly lazy reviser, I'll confess that. Some poets love to revise, but I spend a lot of time in the first draft process. And so my poems are actually, from first draft to final draft, quite close. On occasion, I'll do a workshop. I'll workshop my poems, and I get some really excellent advice from other poets. And I might make some changes. I do some structural changes, but for the most part, I put a lot of time in at the front end, and I don't edit as much as other poets. That's something that I wrestle with a little bit. And I think a lot of poets wrestle with the editing process as well.
So you said in 2012 is when you won the contest, and whether that was when you first started taking yourself seriously as a poet, did you notice that your thinking has changed about the world?
It has. I am so much more observant of the world than I used to be. And, you know, people talk a lot about living life intentionally, but when you write poetry and the world comes to you in a variety of ways, I think knowing that you might make something of it in the poetry makes you attend to that world a little more intensely, and to attend to the people in that world. So I think I've slowed down a lot. I listen to people more carefully. Sometimes I listen to people I shouldn't be listening to. I like to overhear conversations at restaurants and bars, and sometimes those moments make it into my poetry. So that's a way that I think it's really changed me.
Will you write a poem about this experience?
I might. All poets will confess this. We write a lot of poems that some of them make it into books and into journals, and some of them are just part of the process, and they don't make it. So if I do write a poem, we'll see if it makes it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The Lion Sisters. No.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, I don't want to step on anything you've written.
You know, Nancy, Leona mentioned that she likes to listen to overhear conversations at restaurants. I believe one time we were out having ramen and you made fun of me for doing that. So you see, it's okay to do.
I don't recall any of that. Leona, please, what inspired you to put Lion Brothers? I know that's a poem in there, but why did you make that the title of this collection?
Yeah. So Lion Brothers is the name of the factory. It's a sewing factory where my mother worked for over 25 years. My mother is a South Korean immigrant. And when she came to this country, she had very, very few language skills. And so her job choices were very limited. And so she worked at this factory, and it was a profound experience, I think, for all of us. I think about it a lot. You know, she was an incredibly hard worker, and the work was physically extremely grueling. And, you know, she's just a tiny woman. She's about 5 feet tall and weighs all of 100 pounds. And she used to climb up on these giant machines, these incredibly noisy machines, and she would thread looms all day. And, you know, and one of the things that I remember when I was a kid every couple of months or so, she would come home and she'd have needle sticks. So sometimes the needles would break and they, you know, a machine would shove them into your fingers. And so, I remember being terrified by that as a child. And for her, it was just, a way to support her family. And so Lion Brothers was actually one of the very first poems I wrote. And I didn't think it was going to be the title of the collection. It was a very emotional poem to write. And, you know, if you talk to poets, they'll tell you they think of a number of different titles for collections. Very often the title will come from a poem. And I remember I was talking to another poet. I was talking to Erica Meitner, who she teaches at Tech, and she's a wonderful poet. And I was telling her, you know, the variety of titles I was sort of considering for the collection. And I said, well, she said, well, tell me some more. You know, she didn't like any of the ones that I mentioned to her. And I said, well, I have this poem. You know, it's called Lion Brothers. She said, that's the one. Mm. And she was right.
Well, I guess that's how you know, right? When it feels right, is that fair to say?
Or? Well, I knew, I guess it was because it felt right. But, you know, I was also at the time a big fan of Erica Meitner's. And when she said it was right, I said, of course, it's right. But it felt right,
too.
There's that. There is that.
And what about, because well, obviously you spent time not only writing the poems, but putting them in that order. So how did you... I know we're getting close to a break, but I'll ask. How did you arrive at that? Was that a tough decision to put them in the order you put them in?
That is an excellent question. It's one that I wrestled with for a very long time, and I got some help. I had some help from Martha Collins, who is a great poet. I was in a workshop with her. She was very generous. She read my manuscript and ordered the poems. And then when the book was chosen by Press 53, Tom Lombardo, is a fantastic editor, and he made some other recommendations for ordering, and so I learned from the two of them.
We're speaking with award-winning poet Leona Sevick. Her website is Leona Sevick, SEVICK.com. We'll be right back. We're going to talk more with her, and then after that, Alex Redder, professor at the University of Virginia School of Engineering and Applied Science. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something on this special edition in honor of the Virginia Festival of the Book. We have poet Leona Sevick here. She is provost and professor of English at Bridgewater College in Virginia. And she has won her latest book, Lion Brothers, has won the 2017 Press 53 Award for Poetry. So, Leona, I wanted to ask you about who your favorite writers are, who you're reading now.
Well, I of course read a lot of poetry, and so I have been reading Joseph Asano's The Crossing. That's a wonderful collection. January Gill O'Neill's Rewilding is an amazing book, and I just had the pleasure of reading with January here at the New Dominion Bookshop for the Virginia Festival of the Book, and that was a wonderful experience. Also, Rebecca Morgan Frank, who read with me. They're wonderful poets. My guilty pleasure is fiction, so I read quite a bit of fiction. A couple months back, I read Snowden Wright's American Pop. That's a really fun book. I generally read one novel at a time, but I will read multiple collections of poetry at a time. Melissa Stein's Terrible Blooms is a book I just picked up this week, and I cannot put it down. I'm already about three-quarters of the way through it, so that's a fantastic book.
Ellen, is she reading it while we ask her questions? Is that what's going on?
No, she's very intentionally...
It's essentially a competition now. Forget the fact that we may be immortalized. I feel like she's just reading, actually.
She's a multitasker. She's reading and
exactly.
Speaking.
Well, speaking of reading, actually, how are you, Leona, about, do you read your reviews? How are you about all that?
You know, I do read them. I read them obsessively, and I'm always grateful when folks read my work and they comment on it. And generally in, you know, the poetry world, reviews are quite generous. And so I've been really appreciative of the folks who've read my work and commented on it. And I think that, you know, the collection is varied enough that there is maybe something in it for everybody. So I've been very fortunate and very happy with those reviews.
So speaking of that, I wanted to read what Arthur Say, author of Compass Rose, wrote. He said, Lion Brothers has been called a psychologically astute, keen, and powerful sequence of poems that harness the luminous particulars of experience and race to reveal worlds within and behind the immediate visible one. And so that leads me into to ask you about Furious Flower Poetry Centers. Can you tell us why that's important to you?
Yes, absolutely. So I moved to Virginia almost 3 years ago, and I lost my writing community when I moved. And so I got to know some poets from the Harrisonburg, Bridgewater area. And I got to know Lauren Elaine, who is the assistant director of the Furious Flower Black Poetry Center, and Joanne Gabin, who is the director. It is the first black poetry center in the country. And it's actually celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. We're doing a big celebration at the African American Culture and History Museum in September. And they've been just a wonderful, wonderful group of people to work with. And I've been very happy to be invited into their ranks.
And you're on the advisory board of that center.
I am.
Great.
And in terms of the work in Lion Brothers, you know, I know you talked actually about the domestic aspects that are included in there, but you also, I was wondering how guns wind up as a subject as well for you. How did you arrive at that as a important?
So my father was a police officer, actually. He's a retired state trooper from Maryland, and so I grew up with guns in my home. They were never locked. My brother and I learned to handle guns at a very young age, and I have a very, very ambivalent relationship with guns. I both fear them and I don't fear them. I have, of course, been resistant to having guns in my own home. But, you know, my children know that this is an aspect of my life. And so we talk about it. And you know, my son, I have a teenage son who is of course interested in target shooting and things like this. And so, we've had lots of conversations. And of course those conversations have ended up in my poems, and it is a very emotional subject for me. It's one that I think I'll probably never stop wrestling with in my work.
It sounds like, well, actually, let me ask this way: what is your goal when you a thought like that or a feeling like that? What is your goal when you put that into poetry?
Yeah, I think it's every poet's goal, you know, to put what's in your heart on the page. To somehow find a way to do that and to make the reader feel something. And it doesn't have to be the same thing that you feel as a writer, but to feel something significant. I think that's the goal. It's a simple goal and a complex one all at once.
Who are your inspirations in your life?
I've mentioned my mother already, and I think my work ethic comes from my mother.
Are you very disciplined in your writing? Is that your routine?
I'm not. I'm disciplined in my day job, in my work life. But I try to write something every day. I used to get up very early in the morning when my kids were young and write. And that was the only time I had time to write. So I was a little more disciplined then when they were very young. But I try to keep pen and paper with me at almost all times. I write a lot in my head. I run, and so I do a lot of thinking about lines again and again, and running is a good activity for that. But I'm not disciplined. I wish I were more disciplined.
Well, that's I don't know. That's encouraging for the rest of us who aren't disciplined, because you've accomplished so much. So that's interesting. When you're running, do you get lines in your head? Or is it that you're working on lines while you're running, or both?
Both. It happens in both ways. And I, you know, sometimes I run with music as well, and so I have to sort of turn the music down and let the other music sort of play in my head. I have to make a choice there, but it can be either. I used to write a lot when I was driving, and I decided that was a dangerous thing to do. So I stopped.
Better to text.
No, that's right. Better to No, don't do that, kids. That's
kidding. Sorry. Your work, not only in your own books, but it's appeared in, as Ellen alluded at the beginning, in many anthologies and collections. So I was just wondering, do you have any favorite anthologies where you're most, you know, pleased that your work has appeared?
Yeah, I think Ellen may have mentioned the Golden Shovel anthology. That's an anthology that came out. It's edited by Terrence Hayes. And what I love about that anthology is that it has the Golden Shovel form, which is a form that honors honors Gwendolyn Brooks, and in particular, it's an anthology that invites very well-known writers, folks like Nikki Giovanni and Mark Doty, and poems by those writers appear alongside high school students who have written these Golden Shovel forms to honor Gwendolyn Brooks' poetry. And it's a wonderful anthology, and I'm very, very pleased to be a part of it.
And in, you know, because this is relatively new, and maybe even if it wasn't, but you obviously are here, you're at the Book Fest. How are you about promoting yourself? I mean, it's such a personal thing you do. So how are you with all of that and your work, you know, promoting your work?
I'm terrible at it.
That is not what I heard.
I don't think so. Ellen, do you think so?
Anyway,
I'm sorry.
I'm not good at book hawking. I'm not good at that. Mm-hmm. I can read. I love to read my poems. I love to listen to other people read. I have a kind of a hard time book selling. So my press is a wonderful press, Press 53, and so, you know, when I go to the big AWP conference, I stand at the table and I talk to people, and I end up talking to people about other people's books, you know, the books that I enjoy reading and that I want them to buy. And then, you know, inevitably somebody will say, well, do you have a book? And I say, well, yeah, I have this book. I have this book. Are you interested in this book? Uh-huh. So, the more I do it, I guess the more comfortable I get.
I find that artists have a hard time being, you know, putting on a different hat, because it's a totally different thing. You know, that's why we have agents and salespeople and reps.
That's right.
And things like that.
That's
so.
Right. Poets generally don't have agents. You know, fiction writers have agents, but mm-hmm. that would be a lot easier.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Leona, what drew you to initially a long part of your career was the research and the work you did on Willa Cather. So what appealed to you so much about her?
Well, actually, it was her writing about immigrants. I love the Prairie novels. I love O Pioneers and My Antonia and Song of the Lark. And when I was casting about for a subject for my dissertation, I was, you know, really just drawn to those novels. And then I was at University of Maryland College Park, and my advisor ended up being Mary Lee Lindemann, who is she's a Cather scholar, and she is a wonderful, wonderful teacher and a wonderful scholar. And so I was drawn to the fiction of Cather, but I was also drawn to Mary Lee, who I knew would be just a wonderful advisor in that long, sometimes stressful process.
And in terms of the book itself now, Lion Brothers, do you love them all equally? Do you have, I know Lion Brothers is the titled one, but do you love them all equally, or do you have favorites?
I don't love them all equally.
Well, I love the honesty.
Yeah. You know, there are a couple of poems in there, and I think this happens, despite the wonderful editing that I did receive. And not all writers are lucky enough to have a great editor, but I was. Tom Lombardo's a wonderful editor, and he pulled some poems out that were not worthy of the collection. He left a couple in that, you know, he wanted me to take a chance on them. And sometimes I look at those poems and I think, oh, I could have done that a little bit better. You know, I think that happens. So unlike the way I love my children. I don't. Did you hear that?
And I saw it. I saw your eyes.
I don't love them all equally.
So, thank you so much for being here, Leona Sevek. If you could leave us with one thought that you didn't get to say in the interview, what would you want to say?
Well, I just said I'm not good at promoting my own work, but I am working on another manuscript. And so there are some poems out there in wonderful journals, and Southeast Review and the Arkansas International. So if you're interested in what's coming in my next book, please take a look at those publications.
That's great. And we will promote this. And this podcast will be available on iTunes, and we'll send it to you, and we'll promote it all over the place.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yes. Hey, Nancy, it's so funny to ask you if you have a news of note when we've been talking about
news. I'm going to put it. Oh, we didn't ask Leona if she likes a good rhyme.
Do you like a good rhyme?
I love rhymes. But okay, well, I don't write them, but I love them.
Yeah, I was going to say. Why do you ask? Nancy?
Only because it's the instinctual thing with poetry. But the thing is, Leona and Ellen, my news of note doesn't rhyme, and I have no idea why I dug this hole for myself. So please go back to your novel or whatever it is you're reading, Leona. Anyway.
She called it a cul-de-sac.
Estuary. I want to use that twice in a week. I'm throwing it out there. Anyway.
Girl.
Yes, I have some news of note. It doesn't rhyme, as I've already confessed. It is about this. In November, 65% of Floridians had voted to approve an amendment to give the state's constitution, to amend the state's constitution to restore voting rights to eligible former felons. This is about 1.5 million people. Many who have started to register this amendment took effect in January of this year. But, the Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, and his GOP-controlled legislature have now decided that they want to write new legislation that would first require all these felons to pay back all the court fees and fines, even though they have agreed to slowly pay them off in court-approved payments, et cetera. They are making this now the new amendment. You know, they're amending the amendments before these people can register. They have to meet that bar, again, ignoring the will of the people. The amendment didn't specify first paying back these fines. And this barrier is going to, if it holds, if it becomes law, it's going to affect all of them being eligible, or some of them, being eligible to vote in 2020. That's how subversive they are to the will of the people. That's what I got.
Well, I didn't prepare a news of note, but it somehow reminds me of this wonderful speaker I heard this week, Ruth King, who talked about the ugliness that we're seeing, the racism and oppression, it's the blooms of consciousness that were planted a long time ago. That this is nothing that just popped out. These are things coming out now that have been, you know, seething and happening for a really long time. And so what we do now also becomes a bloom that could be, you know, the seeds that could bloom in the future. So what we're doing now, I think, is important, speaking out as much as we can, and bringing people, you know, and listening to, I don't know, just expanding our consciousness to learn about what's going on. Like today earlier, we heard about American Indians and the horrible policy that went on there that we really weren't taught. So we're just not even taught half of the stuff that we talk about on this program, Nance.
Well, Ellen, I was going to say that I'm being totally serious. That was a very poetic way to connect Ruth King's work to the current state. It is quite poetic.
Yeah. Well, those were her great words.
Yes, I understand.
I know, but thank you.
Sure.
We like to compliment each other. That's our friendship. So with no further ado, as I always say, I wanted to introduce our next guest. But I need a minute, Nance. Can you tap dance?
Oh, you do?
A minute.
Well, that reminds me of some other rhyme schemes. here's something, because I fear I won't get to put this in at the end.
Okay.
It is women's. Interrupt me when you need to, Ellen.
Soon.
It is Women's History Month, and March 29th. So it's getting close. They waited to the very end for the March 29th. NASA is going to have the first all-female spacewalk.
Oh, that's amazing.
But they're going to have one. This woman,
it's in space.
Astronauts Anne McLean and Christina Koch are going to be doing the whole thing up in the International Space Station. March 29th. I'm done.
Thank you. Look how ready you were. I just said, please take it, and you totally went with it. Thank you.
Okay.
Our next guest is Alex Zaretta. He is a professor at the University of Virginia School of Engineering and Applied Science. He is the Assistant Director for Technology Entrepreneurship and Program Director for Works in Progress. He's a technology entrepreneur and was just named the 2019 Innovator of the Year Award by Charlottesville Business Innovation Council. He works to inspire entrepreneurial students and their dreams to create startups, nonprofits, or new devices. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so tell us about what Works in Progress is all about.
Works in Progress is a community of student entrepreneurs that are working with each other on separate projects to help each other weather the difficulties and really get through that existential crisis that is being an entrepreneur every day.
Yeah. So I imagine everyone wants to invent something and become successful, whatever that means. So is there a lot of pressure that they're feeling?
A lot of pressure? No, I wouldn't say pressure. It's more self-driven for a lot of them. A lot of them feel a little bit different. They are honestly a little bit different than most of the people out there. They have this intrinsic motivation to move forward. And so what this community provides them is like-minded people who are a lot like them. And what most people aren't like, but, everyone has the potential to be.
So we're going to go to a break. I'm sorry, right at the first question, but it's a hard break. And we'll be right back. More with Alex Zaretta. Stay tuned. We have lots more to come. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are speaking with Alex Zaretta, and this is Apropos of Something on the special program at noon. We're still going to be airing from 10 to 11 every Saturday, but we just added this bonus program. And during the break, Alex very gently and nicely corrected me on everything I said about him was wrong. He is not a professor. He's not even in the studio right now. I don't know. You were nominated for that award, prestigious award, but you didn't win it. You could have just said you won it, and we wouldn't. So I commend you.
I haven't won it yet. It's in May.
Yeah. He's going to win it in May. Oh, anyway. So how did you get to? We were talking about Works in Progress. Mm-hmm. So how did that come about?
So I was a student at UVA. I started 10 years ago, like to almost this August coming up, and I was doing engineering, biomedical engineering, and they told us we had three tracks: med school, grad school, or go get a job. But nobody really told me, or I guess it wasn't emphasized, you could go out and do your own thing. My fourth year, I had this research project that I was really, really passionate about, and I entered this competition called the Entrepreneurship Cup competition. And I ended up winning, which totally, turned my world upside down. The GRE I had just taken was, completely irrelevant because I was going to keep going on with this. I ended up getting a $250,000 translational research grant from UVA, and that ended up being my first full-time job.
Wow.
I was getting paid a lot less than what I would have gotten in an entry-level job, but I was working on something that I was passionate about. Where this started from was I wanted to find that student who was just like me in their first year and give them a little bit of guidance. I didn't know anything really, but I did know something. I knew how to win that competition, and I knew how to get a little bit of a grant to go forward after graduation. And so I did. I started putting on workshops, started helping students win the entrepreneurship competitions, and giving them some validation and really putting them with other people like themselves. And so my project didn't end up working out because after 2 years of working on it, though we built that device, we didn't build it for the right use case, which means that it wasn't really usable. And by that point, when you've been working on something for 2 years and things happen with teams sometimes. But I had been wanting to do this. And in the engineering school, they had been following what I'd been doing, and they were saying, how are you doing this? This could really complement and be a great addition to what we're already doing. And so they brought me in as a consultant at first, and I had learned my lesson from that the project that I had been on before. This time I went out and talked to 500 students who had entered that competition over the last 4 years. And I found some very interesting things. What I found became what Works in Progress is today, just trying to try a bunch of different solutions that were kind of radical and keeping the ones that worked. A lot of them didn't work. And so it's honestly kind of been an entrepreneurial endeavor in and of itself for the past 4 years. A position was created for me. And so here I am to this day, 4 years later.
That's amazing. Yeah. So can you tell us specifically, I mean, a lot of questions mm-hmm. I had, like, what did you do that won you that, what was it, an award or... You won the scholarship or a fellowship or...
The grant.
The grant. You won the grant. And then what did you find out that specifically that we're gonna that was going to help these... And also, what was your project that failed? I mean, too many questions, yeah. But just pick one.
I'll start with that last one.
Okay.
We had this really radical idea of what if you could detect bacterial infection the same way we detect pregnancy right now? This cheap disposable test that anyone can use, if needed, it could be subsidized and given to populations that couldn't afford it. So we were envisioning, like, in the earthquake of Haiti in 2010, there was a huge cholera outbreak. That outbreak was due to there was poor infrastructure, so the plumbing was there, so, you know, cholera spreads in situations like that. And a lot of people live too far away from a hospital so that when the symptoms of cholera show, they can't get the treatment they need. If we got cholera here, you know, we got UVA right down the road, so we could just go there, get some antibiotics and some fluids. But that outbreak, it was pretty bad. So something like this would work there. But for our grant, we had decided to go after food safety, so E. coli 0157. And turns out that's not really necessary. But towards the end of the project, we found out that maybe Listeria would have been a better option. When we started talking to a goat cheese maker in Esmont, Virginia, she was like, wow, I wish I had a test like this for Listeria because it is really expensive and I don't have high profit margins. So that was the project there.
And how did you take your experience, as you said, as a student? What things are you imparting onto the students today in Works in Progress that makes their leap to entrepreneurship better than yours was, you know?
So it started off just, you know, being someone who was a little bit older than them, who had gotten a little bit of success. Since then, you know, I've been working with students who have gone further and farther and faster than I have. Some of them are still in the area, like Kevin Eisenfratz, who graduated in 2015 of Contraline, which is making a non-hormonal, non-surgical, reversible male contraceptive. It's not on the market yet, but, you know, it'll put the power of, reproductive choice, you know, on not just in the women, more of a shared burden. Agrospheres, who were making a pesticide-degrading spray, they're still in Charlottesville as well. And so a lot of it was just that, showing that it's not just an ideal thing that, you know, a lot of people talk about but never get to. It's not just something that you do when you're 10 years out of college. It's something that you can do right now if you really believe in yourself and keep going.
Are you working on projects currently as well as inspiring students?
I've been working on a couple of things on the side. In the beginning, I was trying to make a magazine online in which I could sort of highlight some of these stories at UVA and at the thousands of other colleges across the nation, because it's not just MIT and Stanford and Babson that are producing great student entrepreneurs. Every college, every university has students like this. And so there's a couple of things like that I was doing, but really what it came down to is I knew I needed to focus. And so for the past 4 years, I've been focusing on this.
I was curious because sometimes, you know, students are young and they have their, you know, their set and their mindset. Is it tough for you to get them to see both sides, to the, you know, the high ideals of their invention or their innovation and, you know, and promoting it or getting grant money, the other side of it?
So can you clarify that question?
Yeah, the two sides, whether, you know, whatever the invention is as well as the business side, do you have to convince them to mind both sides of the coin?
Yes, in some ways. I would say those aren't necessarily two sides. They're kind of the same thing in different perspectives. I am in the engineering school, so a lot of the students that I work with they're really about building that technology, and they're worried about, is it feasible to actually build this thing? Like, is the science going to work out? And actually, that's one of the lessons I learned on my project. It's not about whether or not you can build it. I built the thing that I was working on for 2 years. It's whether or not you're building the right thing. You know, if you've got a ladder against the wall and you're climbing up the ladder, when you get to the top, you don't want to find out that you should have put your ladder against a different wall. A lot of what we do is when we talk with these students and meet with them, the first question is, who have you talked to about this? Who could be a potential customer or really any stakeholder in the product?
Well, the program itself, it's still relatively new, but as Ellen has alluded to and said in English, accurate and not, you guys have gotten a lot of attention and you've won a few awards. So what have you already accomplished in your field?
So this started, you know, at UVA trying to fix something that I thought might be an issue. Talking to students, we found that there might be something we could do about it. We ended up building basically a lot of programs that would help cultivate smaller groups of community that would help each other. And these groups were based around this level of engagement on a project. Those who were most highly engaged benefited from each other by, you know, keeping each other accountable to working on this project in the midst of all the other things they had to do. But then also the students who maybe weren't there yet, keeping them going. I ended up going to conferences with for entrepreneurship educators, and I found the same thing at every university. What a lot of these entrepreneurship education professionals were finding was that a lot of the students who were doing these incredible projects and honestly making this school kind of famous were never really engaging with the classes, the clubs, or even the staff. They may come by once, but it was, and I saw this disconnect, and so. In putting together these things, we developed this program. And so we then ended up applying for an award for a pedagogical innovation. And so the Global Consortium of Entrepreneurship Centers, NANBIS is a finalist for this award. We didn't win technically because it's not actually inside the classroom. And so that was that. But they really enjoyed that. And so I've gotten to talk to on a lot of platforms like that and reach a lot of these educators. And I've been working with a couple of different universities to see how we could have the same effect or implement the same kinds of programs at other institutions.
Are there other memorable inventions that you can tell us about? They're so also interesting.
Oh yeah, there's so many. It's not just these amazing technologies that are highly scientific. There was one student who was a neuroscience major, and he liked to surf. So he went around South America, ended up in Cusco, Peru, bought a sweater from a lady in a market. He went back to UVA. Everyone loved the sweater, asked where they could get it. He was like, you gotta go to Peru. So he went back, found that woman, stayed with her, made breakfast for their kids, and found out that these sweaters were something that was a cultural tradition in their village. And they, in order to make a livelihood, they had to do something else that was really amounted to manual labor. And so he was like, he had an idea. He said, my friends love this sweater. Do you think that you guys would be able to make things like this? And I think I could pay you, you could get basically a living wage. And they said, that would be amazing. We don't even make enough money to take our kids to the doctor when they're sick, right? And so he ended up doing that. He sent out Don Designs. He got some pre-orders and launched a Kickstarter that got $400,000 pledged in a month. And he's still here. He's a student, and he lives on the lawn.
That's right? Amazing.
But so there was a success story there.
Yeah, for sure.
And that wound care technology, how did that one come to be?
Right. So Ashwin was in some of my early workshops when he was a first year, and he had this passion for creating a better wound care dressing for it was originally surgical site infections, but through talking with stakeholders and customers, he found out that the biggest need for something like this would be in southern India, where they have a huge, not epidemic, but a lot of cases of diabetic foot ulcers, and they don't have the specialized wound care equipment that we do here in the United States. And so, yeah, he graduated last May, and he's over there. I think he's between Wisconsin and where he's from in India, working with the leading diabetologist there and the leading hospital that deals with diabetes there to actually get this product out there. I think he's a finalist for an international grant for something related to this as well.
So it feels like you need to be a medical doctor to also be an engineer. There's so much of the stuff that intersects with medicine.
Oh, it's not just medicine. The medical ideas are the most they get the most attention.
Yeah.
Because they save lives. But entrepreneurship is, or really a lot of the things you do, it's very interdisciplinary. I mean, even looking back to like an author of a book, talking with Leona, who's an author of a book, you have to learn a lot of skills and knowledge outside your field. And it requires, you know, not being afraid to go out and learn that and talk to the people who might be able to teach you these things.
And you've got that next competition coming up, the ACC Inventor Prize. What is it and what are your chances, sir?
Oh, yeah. So we use a lot of competitions to help these students really realize that this could be a thing. Like I was saying, you make it more of a concrete thing. Leona, we were just talking about how her book came from a competition for poetry. A lot of the same things happen with student entrepreneurs. So the ACC Inventor Prize is one of these competitions that's external to UVA. And this particular one is like Shark Tank, but it's only among the ACC schools. So you know how we got the ACC competition for sports, like basketball, football. This is for entrepreneurship. So it's the 15 schools who are in the ACC, and it's been running. This will be the fourth year. And we're up against schools that have a lot more funding, are a lot more well-known for entrepreneurship, like Syracuse, Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech. And then we've got UVA, which is a great school, but it's not really on the radar, at least in the undergraduate level, for entrepreneurship. And but the last 3 years, we got second place, first place, and then first place again, and then we stole People's Choice away from the home team. And this year, I think we have our most prepared student yet, and student team yet. And they've been receiving mentorship from the past 3 years' winners and then the entire rest of our community. I think we have a very good chance of winning the first place prize, but we will need help in getting that People's Choice Award. If you're able to watch, it's live streamed, and there's like a very short window in which you can text in to a certain number to vote for them.
Where can we find you? Is it devhub.virginia.edu or another site?
No, that's one of our sites was over there. You can find me on the engineering school's website within the entrepreneurship and business part of that website. But I do want to indicate that I'm not the only one that works in entrepreneurship at the University of Virginia. We have a constellation of people who work within, you know, I'm in the engineering school. We got the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy that does social entrepreneurship, the Gallant Center in Commerce. We got Darden. And so we have an overarching website of entrepreneurship.virginia.edu that is sort of that front page.
And then your spelling your name is Z-O-R-Y-C-H-T-A.
Yeah, Z-O-R-Y-C-H-T-A.
Yes. People want to Google you.
Yeah.
And quickly, Alex, in terms of why you do this in the first place, because we're not all engineers and scientists and all of that, but why should we all care that this succeeds for all these schools?
That's a really good question. I mean, deep down, that's sort of why we're doing this. So entrepreneurship could be pigeonholed as just this, you know, thing about business, you know, evil capitalists. That's really what I thought it was when I was an engineer. But really what entrepreneurship education is about is empowering people to go out there and make an impact in the world. With entrepreneurship, you can immediately see whether or not your idea is good because either people buy it or not. And so when you start to gain confidence through entrepreneurship and we start to build programs that work to actually to get these entrepreneurs out there, I think that these models of education, especially the co-curricular programming and community development that I've been doing with these students, it can really be applied to the larger part of education to empower anyone to go after problems and in the course of doing that, learn the skills and the knowledge that they need that these educational institutions provide.
Well said. I mean, I would love that. Anything that benefits all of society and empowers us all to take on challenges is sounds very worthy.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up, unfortunately, because I was told yes. I have to end right at the right time. I can't go over.
Yep.
So thank you so much for being here, Alex Zaretta, and also Leona Sevek. It was really a pleasure to talk to both of you on this very special show. So remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Our music is by Springtide. And Nancy, you have 10 seconds. What's on your mind?
Awesome. Randy Rainbow tickets.
That's
May 2nd.
Right.
Let's hear from everyone. We have 3 tickets to give away.
Randy Rainbow is that hilarious guy who's got all the YouTube viral videos criticizing this administration, and they're really hilarious. So he's coming here,
yeah,
which I'm thrilled
AOS
about.
AOS Radio. We have little competitions posted on there. Take
yes.
Look.
So we have questions. If you can get the questions right, if you've listened to the show at all, you'll get the questions right. Tune in. AOS Radio. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.